Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the widespread demonstrations across Venezuela by supporters of the opposition to the Maduro government on the day of the anniversary of the 1958 uprising, which overthrew a military dictatorship. David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and has lived there for 15 years, joins us to discuss his article at The Conversation, Venezuelans Reject Maduro Presidency, but Most Would Oppose Foreign Military Operation to Oust Him. We will assess the impact of the president of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, declaring himself interim president of Venezuela, and President Trump's move to recognize him as the country's interim president, which follows a number of South American countries that have already recognized Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate head of state. And since Trump administration officials met with rebellious Venezuelan military officers back in September, but decided not to support their coup plot, we will explore what options there are for the vast majority of beleaguered and battered Venezuelans to remove from power the unpopular and incompetent Maduro, who has brought an oil-rich country to the brink of starvation and collapse. Then we'll examine Trump's letter to House Majority Leader Pelosi vowing to deliver his State of the Union speech from the House chamber in spite of Pelosi's earlier request that he not show up on January the 29th to deliver his speech elsewhere or in writing as long as the government remains shut down. John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington, D.C., who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, joins us to explain how Trump cannot gatecrash the House to deliver his State of the Union speech, but has to be invited by the Speaker, Madam Pelosi. Then finally, we'll go to Mexico City to speak with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at UNAM and the editor of the Mexico Law Review, as well as a columnist for La Jornada and the weekly magazine Proceso. He joins us to discuss why the Mexican press is downplaying revelations that former President Peña Nieto took a $100 million bribe from the drug lord El Chapo, and Mexico's new president AMLO's efforts to get Trump to deal with violence and corruption in Central America, which are at the root of why migrants seek refuge in the United States. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and lived there for a total of 15 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and has an article at The Conversation, Venezuelans Reject Maduro Presidency, but Most Would Oppose Foreign Military Operation to Oust Him. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smilty.
Thank you.
So, David, Vice President Pence sent a video message. He apparently spoke with Juan Guaido, the young president of the National Assembly, who's a number of South American countries have recognized as Venezuela's legitimate leader. And then today, President Trump also recognized the leader of the opposition, Juan Guaido, as the interim president. So is this going to have any effect on Maduro? It does feel like the outside world is closing in on him, not to mention the fact that the vast majority of the Venezuelan people are just totally fed up with this incompetent, unpopular leader.
Yeah, it's a situation that's developing right now. It's rather confusing. It's not clear what exactly is going to happen. Today, there were massive protests. Today is the 23rd of January and is an important national holiday in Venezuela, precisely because in 1958, this is the day that they overthrew a military dictatorship. And so there were massive marches today. And during the march, Juan Guaido, the president of the National Assembly, declared himself interim president of Venezuela. And this was a step that has been in the works and has been in play for the past 10 days. And he finally took this step. And immediately afterwards, the United States, Canada, Colombia, and a number of other countries in the region recognized him as president. And so now it's a very unclear situation because Venezuela basically has two presidents. Maduro held a press conference earlier today and it has a very defiant attitude and, you know, is basically all of his speeches about United States imperialism. And I think U.S. actions have facilitated that being his focus. But it's very unclear. What is notable right now is that Maduro is giving a speech and the Minister of Defense is not there by his side like the other ministers are. And the suggestions that he is currently talking with the military high command, and it's not clear exactly what's going to come of that.
But that's all Maduro does, though, isn't it? Blame the U.S., gives these ideological speeches while the country goes to hell in a handbasket.
Well, frequently, that's one of his top themes, but sometimes he actually does have to deal with issues like the economy and inflation and food scarcities and migration. And in all those issues, it's much more difficult. He also has to deal with the opposition and deal with protests and the fact that there's this movement that's very gaining momentum. And so, you know, whatever he can do, he's always going to – his basic move is to try and make this – problem, a problem of Venezuela versus the United States instead of the Maduro government versus the Venezuelan people. And so sometimes that's more plausible and sometimes it's less plausible. And so moments like this, it becomes more plausible. But, you know, in the end, he has a really big problem and he's a very unpopular president and he is not seen as legitimate by most Venezuelans nor most of the neighboring countries around him. And so it's a difficult situation.
Well, back in August of 2017, after the U.S. had slapped economic sanctions on Maduro, President Trump said that the United States was considering a military option in Venezuela. And that just clearly played right into Maduro's hands. Now, we're also learning, I think it was just back in September, that a group of military officers met with Trump administration officials. They were plotting a coup against Maduro, but apparently the Trump administration declined to support their plans. What do you know about that secret meeting between, and who were these military officials from Venezuela? And did we know who they met with in the Trump administration?
I think we do know who they met with, and we do know who the people were that were arrested later for being part of this, and we assume that these were the same people that met with administration officials. The that was a military conspiracy that was cooking for about 6 months. That was pretty much disbanded last May. I think the larger point here is that the administration and in general hawks in the U.S. government think that threatening military action or saying there's a military option is a good pressure technique. You know, they think that that's going to make a government cede or change behavior or do something different. And actually, it's not an effective pressure technique. What's happened since in the year and a half since Trump first said that is, of course, it reinforces Maduro's message, but it also, probably more importantly, is it undermines the opposition because the opposition, it drives a wedge through the opposition between those who want to act politically and mobilize politically and those who think, well, we should just abstain, stay home, and let a foreign intervention happen because that's going to be more effective. And so a lot of the deterioration of the opposition over the past year and a half, I think, can be attributed to that military option. Now, the United States the National Security Council had a phone call with journalists today in which they emphasized time and again that, you know, if anything happens to Guaido and this and the other leaders in the National Assembly, and Maduro would be held responsible, and that all options are on the table. So they're very, and they said that time and again. It's very clear that they want people to know that they have a military option, because they think that's going to be effective, an effective threat. And I don't think that's an effective threat. I think it's actually counterproductive. I mean, the real problem here is that, you know, you can certainly understand the United States and other countries have not recognized Maduro's election last May, and I think it was clearly a deficient election, did not meet standards, and I don't think it should have should be recognized. And, you know, so what happens when Maduro, you know, is sworn in? Well, they're not going to recognize him, and now they're in a position they're going to recognize Juan Guaido as the interim president. What this is going to lead to is not clear. And the United States, this doesn't actually open up new ground or open up any new interesting strategies for the United States. It still has the same sort of suite of unattractive options. Basically, there's the military option and there's further sanctions. No, the thing is, any broader economic sanctions are going to end up hurting the people and just exacerbating the migration crisis that's already affecting the region. And the military option, of course, is as undesirable as we know from past U.S. interventions in recent decades. And so the problem is that there are no really good options at this point with reference to Venezuela.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smalley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smalley has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and lived there for a total of 15 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and he has an article at The Conversation, Venezuelans Reject Maduro Presidency, but Most Would Oppose Foreign Military Operation to Oust Him. So there hasn't been a free election in Venezuela since December 2015, when the opposition overwhelmingly in a landslide secured a supermajority. But then since then, Maduro's ruling United Socialist Party have come up with all kinds of tricks to essentially strip the assembly of any powers, and Maduro controls the courts. The one area that seems to be a little shaky, and which is what we're sort of focusing on here today, David, I guess is the military, because Maduro and apparently my understanding is that the Cubans have basically been in there kind of running the show behind the scenes, particularly in terms of the military and the intelligence services. But there are obviously cracks. The fact that the Minister of Defense wasn't there today in Maduro's press conference, how much can you make of that?
Well, I think, this is the real issue. I mean, I think for there to be any kind of transition, the military is going to end up deciding it. No. And so far, you know, they've been quite loyal to Nicolas Maduro, and it's not hard to understand why. Basically, since he became president in 2013, he's given them control over all kinds of economic assets, television stations. They have a bank. They control imports and exports of food. They now control the oil company, mining. No, they have all kinds of economic interests. And so, you know, a lot of them, of course, don't want to lose that. But, you know, at this point, these military officials can be quite pragmatic. If they sort of think that the game is up, I have no doubt at a certain point they're going to end up turning on Maduro. I don't think that they're heavily ideological in the way that Maduro and the people in his inner circle are. And so, you know, that's what it would take. It would take the military to say, you know, we're not going to go along with this anymore. We have to go to elections, and we'll see. We should know in the coming day or two what the military stance is.
But surely the military, particularly the rank and file, have got relatives and families in the neighborhood. They're suffering the same problems, aren't they, as every citizen is? You can't get food, you can't get medicine, you got to line up for hours and hours on end. Inflation, you have hyperinflation, where your savings every day disappear. I mean, it's unbelievable. So surely there must be some level of kind of patriotic rejection of this wrecking crew.
Well, I think there is. No, I think there is, especially the lower down you get. No, and if you think of the different military rebellions that have occurred over the past couple of years, they've basically been at the lower levels, no, of sergeants and lower level soldiers that do an uprising. The uprising on Monday was basically lower level soldiers. And of course they have very little chance of succeeding in doing anything. But these are the people that themselves, you know, suffer and their families suffer. I think when you get up to the higher level, some of the officers, I mean, I think for some of these people, these are the best of times, you know, and they're making huge incomes and are doing really well and can probably support their extended family. And so, you know, it's not uncommon to go into restaurants in Caracas and see a big long table, you know, with three or four military officers and all kinds of family there, and they're wining and dining. And so, you know, I think clearly, as we saw, there was a conspiracy last year among some military officials, and I do think there's some discontent. And I think more than anything else, there's a lot of sort of speculation and people wondering if this is sustainable, if Maduro is not going to drive this right off the cliff. And so, you know, I'm sure that there's some discontent and, you know, Maduro support, even though he has given over the military many goodies. You know, Maduro support is not a slam dunk in the military. I think there's very much of a question there.
Well, just in closing, the intelligence service, Sabin, arrested Juan Guaido recently, and then they let him go. And it seems like he talked his way out of it. He's very young, but he's apparently quite charismatic and very popular. What's your sense of whether, I know Maduro's painting him as a child, but do you think he's a real threat to Maduro?
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually having someone his age and of a different generation is long overdue in the opposition. I think if they had done this a couple of years ago and had somebody as president of the National Assembly who was from this more recent generation of politicians, things would have gone better for them. No, but the thing is, they have these older faces that have old ways of doing things, and that's what, you know, made them much less effective than they could have been. And so, yeah, I mean, I think he's not a seasoned politician, but he brings something new. He certainly captured the attention of people. He has some rhetorical abilities. And so I absolutely think that he is a real threat to the Maduro government. I think, you know, there's that. I also think that within the Maduro government, there's some real issues. And I think you mentioned the arrest of Guaido, the sort of short one-hour arrest. I think that was a clear indication that there are divisions within the Maduro government. No, the more hardliners wanted to arrest Guaido 10 days ago. And I think that started to roll, and some of the more moderate people on the inside said, wait a minute, no, we can't do this. Let's, you know, let this movement go and burn out. And so they released him. No, I think there's a clear indication of divisions within the Maduro government. And I think even today, you know, you look at their speeches and their rhetoric, and they're not quite sure what to do. They're not announcing clearly what they're going to do. And I think they're not sure how to approach this sort of the situation that they've never confronted before.
Well, Davis Maldi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and lived there for a total of 15 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has an article at The Conversation, Venezuelans Reject Maduro Presidency, but Most Would Oppose Foreign Military Operations to oust him. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the tit-for-tat between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump over where he'll deliver his State of the Union now that it appears Trump is looking for alternative venues.
Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
It won't look at night.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. His latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Good to be with you, Ian.
So there's a the to and fro between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump is continuing today, with Donald Trump writing a letter to her basically vowing that he's going to speak in the House chamber. And in the letter he says, it would be so sad for our country if the State of the Union were not delivered on time, on schedule, and very importantly, on location. Now, of course, last week, Nancy Pelosi sent Trump a letter urging him to delay the speech or deliver it in writing. Trump responded by denying Pelosi the use of military aircraft to go to Afghanistan, and then suggested rather, in a rather sort of infantile way, that she should fly commercial. She had to cancel that trip because of security concerns, since effectively the president had outed her. And we all know that the president made a big deal about how, when he flew to Afghanistan over Christmas, how it was very dicey and a lot of security, etc. So that's a little bit of the background here. So what do you think is the next move, John?
The president comes to the Congress to deliver the State of the Union at the request of the Speaker of the House, by tradition. The State of the Union does not have to be delivered in person. It doesn't have to even be delivered at all. It can be a written message, as it was prior to President Wilson about a century ago. So I think there is a certain infantile aspect to saying, I'm coming to your house, whether you want me to or not. I mean, I think anybody who understands the protocols of the Congress and who understands the separation of powers understands that the president doesn't come to the Congress unless the Speaker invites the president to come to the Congress. Now, Mrs. Pelosi did identify the security concerns as one of her concerns, and of course, the president has said that that is not really a legitimate issue, and they need not worry about security. I can't answer to that question because those are fairly classified and confidential determinations that are made. But I do think that there's a second aspect to this, which is I think that the president, the speaker, in all likelihood, would like to see this shutdown resolved and return to normal relations between the presidency and the Congress before the two branches get together for this traditional event.
Well, the ghostwriter of Donald Trump's bestseller, The Art of the Deal, who allegedly wrote the book, actually, and Trump apparently didn't really put pen to paper, but in any case, this fellow Tony Schwartz has tweeted out today, there is one reason I can imagine Trump finding a way to open the government by January the 29th. He desperately wants to give the State of the Union in Congress. It's always, always about his vanity. Now, if Tony Schwartz is right, could that be that Nancy Pelosi's come up with a brilliant way to have Trump open up the government? In other words, it's not about the wall anymore. It's about his vanity. He wants that forum.
I don't think Mrs. Pelosi particularly cares about Donald Trump's vanity one way or the other. I think that her issue is to get the government open, to stop the unnecessary suffering of both federal employees and federal contractors who are now losing out on a second paycheck, and also to use the situation to address the immigration problem and the humanitarian crisis on the border with Mexico that the Trump administration has exacerbated. So I really don't believe that Mrs. Pelosi's motivations here would be based on trying to maneuver the president or embarrass the president. I think she is saying, in an institutional and constitutional basis, we need to have the government open and operating. Let's do that. Let's normalize that situation. Then we can deal with all these other disagreements that we have among us on partisan grounds or on political grounds. You know, she did this with President Bush very successfully. She had any number of serious disagreements with him on policy grounds, but they always got along and they always found a way to respect the integrity of each other's branch of government. I think that's really what's what's been missing here with the president's response, both to the funding crisis and the shutdown, and also to this issue over the speech.
And again, I'm speaking with John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California at Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Speaker Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. His latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. So when you've got Kellyanne Conway at the White House saying today the president intends to go to the chamber on Tuesday night to address our great nation and give them an update on the State of the Union, it would be, I think, remarkably petty of the speaker to disinvite the president of the United States to address the nation that they both serve at the highest level. So, of course, tomorrow, Thursday, is the big sort of showdown in the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has set up competing votes to end the shutdown. Obviously, the Republicans still want the $5.7 billion for the wall that Trump, had, of course, had always said Mexico was going to pay for. And that's his precondition for opening up the government. And the Democratic's precondition for opening up the government is to open up the government and then negotiate. So what do you think is going to happen in terms of breaking this impasse?
Well, I think the pressure here is going to be on Republican members of the Senate. I don't think there's any way that funding for $5.7 billion in funding for a wall is going to pass the Senate. It needs 60 votes. There are 53 Republicans. I don't think they're going to get that number of Democrats. I think the question here is, will the Senate pass the same kind of legislation they passed only a few weeks ago on a bipartisan basis, which is funding to keep the government open and then continue the discussions over the question of the wall? That is the legislation that Mrs. Pelosi has brought before the House, I think, six times now, and the House has passed it. It's passed the same legislation the Senate passed under Republican control only a few weeks ago. That legislation, which I think is probably some variation of what will be the second vote in the Senate yet tomorrow, vote on funding without a wall, if they would simply pass that and send it to the House, I think the House would approve it, and then the government would open, all this unnecessary hardship would be ended, and we could move along to a conversation about how to deal with the border situation, whether that's a wall or some other border security issues. But the pressure there will be on the Republicans in the Senate. Will 13 of them vote with the 47 Democrats to do what far more than 13 of them voted to do only a few weeks ago? If they will simply recreate that vote tomorrow, then the government will be open on Friday and will be back to business as usual with respect to so many crucial functions of government, and we can continue to have this discussion about border security, and we can continue to have the State of the Union as well. So that's why I say the pressure is on a fairly small number of Republicans to simply do again in the Senate tomorrow what they did in December. If that happens, this whole crisis could be over in a matter of hours.
But given that there are two votes, and I imagine McConnell will schedule the Republican vote first,
that's right,
which is $5.7 billion, and then we'll open up the government, and the Democratic vote, the second vote, demanding nothing exchanged for opening up the government. So how do you think the vote's going to go? Because
I think that first vote's going to fail, and I think everybody knows it's going to fail because it needs 60 votes to be taken up in the Senate. It's not going to have 60 votes. So my guess is that the question here is, you know, let's keep in mind something. It's only very recently, it's only since the Democrats won control of the House that Senator McConnell, or for that matter, President Trump, has required funding for a border wall to be a precondition for approval of appropriation bills to keep the government open. That's it. Before November the 7th of last year, that was never a condition of keeping the government open. Now, suddenly, it is a condition of keeping the government open. So that's why I say that second vote tomorrow, which is the funding that the Senate had already approved in December, which the Senate could pass tomorrow and send over to the House, that, I think, would take care of this problem. It would open the government up again. But I don't see any realistic way that the Senate would pass, and certainly not that the House would pass, the first version of the bill, which had to do with $5.7 billion, which which will be the first vote tomorrow, but was never a vote until after the election last year.
And what about a compromise in terms of the Democrats saying, well, we'll spend $5.7 billion, but it won't be on the wall. It'll be on border security, ports of entries, more immigration judges, the kind of stuff that they've been floating. Do you think that's going to happen at some point or other?
I mean, that would make a lot of sense. I don't know if the right amount of money is $5.7 billion. You know, again, there haven't been extensive hearings on this. We don't even know where that number comes from. But Democrats have already voted to strengthen border security. They've even voted for some types of barriers in areas where it's absolutely essential. What they won't support is a barrier across the whole border, which incidentally would not cost 5.7, it cost more like 26 billion, and I'm sure by the time that was all said and done, it'd be closer to $35 billion. So Democrats have been in support of stronger border security, of more surveillance, of drones, of electronic equipment, of improving the quality of detention facilities. All those things are on the table. I think the only issue here is whether or not you squander billions of dollars on something which would have no appreciable impact on the very problems that the president points to, which are the criminal activity coming across the border or drug activity coming across the border. Those don't come across the border that way. They fly into LAX, and that's not going to be helped by having a wall between the United States and New Mexico or the United States and Mexico. That's just not going to work.
Well, we're learning all about that from the trial of El Chapo, the drug lord in Manhattan, the incredibly creative ways that they get the drugs through these ports of entries, including, you know, plastic bananas stuffed with heroin and cocaine. So,
right. That's why I think everybody who really is being serious and not political about this problem looks at the kind of a wall the president's talking about as a fourth century solution to a 21st century problem. I don't even know how well the Great Wall of China kept the Mongols out of China after some period of time, but it certainly isn't working if you look at places where there are these kinds of walls, whether it's on the American border or the Palestine Gaza border with Israel. That there are tunnels, there are other ways of circumventing, and you know there are jet aircraft. So that is not the way to enhance border security. Other areas of border security, I don't think there's any debate. I think the Democrats have indicated and have voted repeatedly. I think even in their last bill, they've had over $1 billion for additional border security. I don't really think the border security is an issue. That's why this is such an intractable problem. The president just seems to be fixated on the idea of a physical wall, almost without regard to whether or not it really would enhance border security and reduce the kind of trans-border movement of contraband and criminal elements that he seems so fixated on. There doesn't seem to be a relationship between the two ideas.
Well, is it possible though that this is a president who doesn't know how to govern, but who knows reality TV and knows how to create government by stunt on a daily basis, and which he does, there's no question.
Yeah.
As a journalist, I have to cover him, and I'm getting whipsawed every day by phony crises. Since the Democrats a while back offered $25 billion for this wall in exchange for a permanent solution to DACA, he turned that down. That indicates to me that he really doesn't want a solution. He wants this permanent crisis bubbling up because that's how he does business.
I'm not sure that Democrats ever offered $25 billion for a wall, but they certainly have indicated a willingness to support enhanced border security. But more to your point, Ian, I agree. I mean, I think the one thing we know for certain about President Trump is he likes to create crises. Crises work for him. They allow him to exercise power. They allow him to dominate the news media. I don't think that I'm not even sure that the president views the current situation as a crisis per se. I think he sees it more as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, we're just learning now that Nancy Pelosi has responded to Trump's letter with her own, basically telling him that, quote, again, I look forward to welcoming you to the House on a mutually agreeable date for this address when government has been opened. And it looks as though Trump is resigned to delivering the State of the Union somewhere else. And he's apparently, the White House is now saying that Trump is exploring alternative venues. So it looks like the tit-for-tat will continue along with the government being shut down. Well, just in closing, how do you think the court of public opinion is going to come down at the end of the day here? You've got Sarah Sanders saying on Fox News today, Democrats have got to stop playing politics. Nancy Pelosi has got to start putting the American people ahead of partisan politics. And of course, that's a little bit a black hole in terms of recent history, because we all saw Trump in the Oval Office say that he would be proud to shut down the government. He'd be happy to take the mantle and responsibility. So where do you think end of the day this is going to come out, just in terms of public opinion? Because you've got all these government workers about to miss their second paycheck on Friday.
Well, I think that if you look at polling, the polling has been really very consistent. The polling has indicated that the public is holding President Trump and congressional Republicans primarily responsible. And in fact, even some portion of people who say they support Trump or even support Trump's position hold him accountable for the shutdown. I mean, his numbers on the shutdown are weaker than his numbers overall. So I don't know that there's any particular event that will occur that will shift that public opinion. I think people throughout the country, regardless of party and ideology, are putting blame where blame ought to appropriately be. Again, I don't know that the president is terribly concerned with public opinion beyond that of a very small base of his people. So I'm not sure that public opinion ultimately is going to move him. I think what will move him ultimately is probably going to be when that public opinion affects Republican members of Congress and they come to him and say, look, this has gone on too long. We have real suffering in our community. We have real economic impact. You know, there's talk of that half a point of GDP is lost each month each week that this shutdown goes on. At some point, those members of Congress are going to go to him, just as Republican members of Congress went to President Nixon and said, this isn't working. We need to do something different. And I think that's where you'll see some movement by the president, not because he sees any sort of problem with respect to his own personal popularity. I think he lives in his own world as to what he can say and do and still sustain the support of a minority, but very loyal minority of Americans.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, well, thank you, Ian. It's good to talk with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. And his latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Mexico City to talk about why the Mexican press is downplaying the revelations that the former president took a $100 million bribe from the drug lord El Chapo. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And now joining us from Mexico City is Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who is an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, UNAM. He's also the editor of the Mexican Law Review, and he's contributed to many publications in the U.S. and Mexico and the U.K. on the topics of corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. And he is a columnist at the Mexican daily La Jornada and at the weekly magazine Proceso. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mill Ackerman.
Thank you, Ian. A pleasure, as always, to speak with you.
Well, thank you, John. And I'm kind of puzzled as to why the Mexican press are downplaying this bombshell of a story that came out of the trials of El Chapo Guzman in Manhattan, where, according to a Colombian drug lord, Cifuentes, the Mexican president, Peña Nieto, first reached out to El Chapo Guzman about the time he was elected president in late 2012, and he asked the drug lord for $250 million in exchange for calling off a nationwide manhunt from him. And apparently the charge is that Peña Nieto settled for $100 million. Why are the local press down there playing this down?
Well, it's been coming out, for instance, that the Proceso magazine is the one that where I write for as well, has been very, very much on top of this issue. On the social networks, it's getting plenty of attention. But the dominant media here in Mexico probably ended up receiving a lot of that money in, to be frank about it, you know, that money came in and that was used for the task of, you know, personal corruption, but also for the task of, you know, public corruption, buying off media and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I can't prove this, but it's very clear that these media have been very close to the previous administrations. They have publicly received incredible amounts of money in government advertising, but also plenty of money under the table. And so this is not just about Peña Nieto. It's about an entirely corrupt system. And, you know, don't throw stones if you're living in glass houses.
But what's going on then with AMLO, the new president, López Obrador? Why is he remaining silent?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at this. One is that these are, you know, allegations. These are not actually any kind of conviction going on for that topic. And so as president of a country, he needs to be, you know, responsible in his public declarations. He has been the first person in his entire campaign and for many years to speak precisely of the depths of the corruption in the Mexican government. So it's not like he's somehow hiding from this, but he's, you know, trying to be responsible as the public voice. And on the other hand, he is trying to look ahead in general. What he has said is that in March or April, he's going to submit for a national consultation the question of whether he should try and, you know, convict if there is enough evidence on the future presidents, or whether in Mexico we should put a period at the end of this moment of history and move on. His position has been that he doesn't want to get tied up in, historic cases, but he wants to move forward with structural reforms. That is definitely also a very clear aspect of the way in which he's looking at justice and transitional justice toward the future.
And how is he handling this recent tragedy where people were tapping into an oil or gasoline pipeline and it ignited, and I think about 100 people were burned alive?
Yes, well, this is a huge, terrible tragedy, and which comes in the context of López Obrador's challenge to an incredible national, international even ring of theft of oil. It's not just about, you know, low-scale communities tapping off oil from the ducts, but these are, you know, very well-organized organizations and linked also to previous governments. With the same sort of focus, instead of just sort of jailing a couple people, what he has been doing is actually trying to reform from the inside the working of the oil distribution and production industry. The explosion was precisely at one of these locations in which the oil was being stolen. There was a huge, you know, geyser of gas that was created, And there's investigation going on right now, but there's even suspicions that it was somehow a sabotage or a provocation in order to send a message to López Obrador for him to stop this anti-corruption crusade. What he has done is, you know, he's been having press conferences two or three a day to try to provide information to the public about what exactly caused this explosion and to attend to the victims. But he's also been very clear that he's not going to give up on this crusade to stop the theft of oil and the corruption which comes from even from, you know, inside the oil company itself.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mel Ackerman, who's in Mexico City. He's the author of as well as professor at the Institute for Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, the UNAM. He's also editor of the Mexican Law Review and a columnist at La Jornada and at the weekly magazine Proceso. So obviously enormous amounts of revenue are being lost. And as you just mentioned, Pemex, the national company, certainly the union has been incredibly corrupt. It's also been a part of the pre-party slush fund, has it not? So it's a daunting task, I guess. But how much is it still a big chunk of the nation's revenue, oil?
Yes, well, oil still provides about a quarter of the national budget, about 5 or 6% of GDP. It comes in through the oil company. And so it's a major support still for government spending and the budget. The corruption is not only in the union. Actually, López Obrador has been very specific about how it's mostly, or most importantly, coming from top executives and even private gas stations and oil companies. It's a whole system of sort of siphoning off the natural wealth for private interests, and that's what he's trying to stop. He calculates that in 2018, Pemex lost 60 billion pesos. So you got to divide that by 20. What would you get there? You know, 30. That'd be $30 million, or in the year. And so this is a major hit at the coffers, national budget, and at Pemex itself. And what he wants to do is not only stop the theft, but also to get Mexico back on its feet in terms of oil sovereignty and independence. Because today, even though Mexico is a major oil producer, it imports more than half its gasoline, because we haven't built in Mexico a refinery for over 30 years. We've just been pumping the gas, the petroleum out, sending it to Texas, have Texas refine it, and then it's brought back in and we use it in our cars, which is not exactly the most lucrative way of, you know, getting that value added for the national economy.
So let's turn back to the trial of El Chapo in Manhattan, John Mel Ackerman. And we mentioned the explosive charge that El Chapo had paid a $100 million bribe to Peña Nieto, the former president of Mexico, who asked for $250 million. That's pretty extraordinary. But what's coming out of this trial is having an impact, or one would think it would have an impact, I'm not sure it is, on the major political standoff happening here in the United States between President Trump, who wants to build his wall, and the House Democrats, who want him to open the government before negotiating border security. And Trump's argument about the wall is it stops all these terrible Middle Eastern terrorists and drugs and rapists and murderers that he's characterized come up from Mexico. But of course, and MS-13 as well, he keeps harping on that. But he does push the drug angle a lot. And what we're learning from the trial of El Chapo is how inventive El Chapo was in bringing drugs into this country. And the argument that the Democrats are leveling at the White House is, look, a wall's not going to stop the drugs. The drugs come through the ports of entry. And certainly the evidence coming out of this trial indicates the extraordinarily creative ways that El Chapo has found to move his drugs through these ports of entries.
Yes, exactly. I mean, as long as there's a demand, the supply will find a way to get through. It'll be, you know, hard for a wall to stop things. You know, there are all these, you know, the tunnels, the, you know, catapults setting things over walls. I mean, there's a million ways of getting things over the border when the demand is there. Obviously, the wall is not going to stop drugs. It might stop people, or at least, you know, direct people towards more dangerous areas, which would create higher risks and a higher death toll on migrants, which could, you know, deter some migration. But this is a pretty draconian way of doing that. What López Obrador has proposed, the New Mexican government, is, you know, trying to cut a deal with Trump to bring, you know, development to southern Mexico and Central America. There's been some progress on that. It's actually very interesting that Trump and López Obrador are, quote unquote, getting along, even though they are, have such different ideologies and are supposedly, you know, both, you know, highly nationalistic, although their nationalists are very different. But up till now, there hasn't been any kind of open conflict. López Obrador has been letting Trump yell and scream and try to focus on the basics in terms of economic development to the south, having people in southern Mexico and Central America have the right to stay where they want to be, because most people want to, you know, live in their communities they were born in, and have migration be a choice instead of something that happens by desperation or force.
Well, some of the revelations, you know, apparently El Chapo preferred smuggling the drugs through normal-looking passenger cars with secret compartments. But one of the things that came up in the trial was drug-filled plastic bananas, which is extremely creative. So obviously now they're arguing, the House Democrats and the president, about the money. And the Democrats want him to open the government first, of course, but they also want him to dedicate this money to cleaning up the ports of entry where these drugs come through. Is that a fool's errand? I mean, at the end of the day, it would make more sense for the American people to stop consuming drugs, but I don't know how you achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of commerce going across the borders is so huge that it's just impossible to get all the drugs. I mean, if you do a random stratified sample, you could probably get some stuff based on suspicion, but for every the plastic banana you get, another 10 will go through. And so, yeah, like you said, I mean, the real issue is demand, and on one hand. On the other hand, in Mexico, it's development, because on the Mexican side, we've had this terrible drug war for the last 12 years, in which, you know, over 250,000 people have died, over 30,000 disappeared. And the new government wants to change that, wants to bring the focus on development, on they've been talking about legalization of some drugs following the U.S. example, price supports for the countryside, scholarships for youth. So if that goes along with a real demand-reducing policy in the United States, we could start, you know, taking serious steps towards peace. Because this sort of militarized strategy, both in Mexico and the prohibitionist strategy in the United States, have obviously not worked to create conditions for development.
So let's, in the last couple of minutes, talk about López Obrador's attempts to make more life more livable in the poorer parts of southern Mexico, and in particular in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, where there's been an exodus of people coming up here. I think the majority probably are economic migrants, but they also are fleeing drugs, drug gangs and street gangs like MS-13 in El Salvador. And the young parents are basically sending their kids off, risking their lives because the kids are threatened. You either join the drug gangs or they kill you. So it's so logical that we should be focusing on how to make life more livable for the people in these countries. So what is López Obrador telling Trump, do you think?
Well, he's really trying to change the strategy, because the last two governments with Calderón and Peña Nieto, the last 12 years, Mexico has basically tried its best to fit itself into the U.S. dictated strategy of, you know, stopping the migrants. The southern Mexican border with Guatemala has been beefed up on security. We don't have a wall there yet, but there's been a real concerted attempt to, you know, stop Central American migrants, and also to, you know, detain and deport as many Central Americans as possible en route through Mexico. You know, the last few years, Mexico's deported more Central Americans than the United States. And so what López Obrador is proposing to do is, you know, really just turn this around, make Mexico a more welcoming place for Central American migrants, bring development to the southern part of Mexico, also to the northern border of Mexico. He's cut taxes and created new investment incentives for this northern border of Mexico, so that people can, you know, as they're moving up to the United States, get detained in a good way in terms of, you know, find a job, be able to settle down and not have to go all the way to the United States. That's been his strategy, and that's what he's trying to convince Trump to buy into that strategy as the really effective way. If he really doesn't want people coming over the border, well, let's bring real possibilities for well-being south of the border. And like you said, some of it's economic migration, but much of it is out of violence, and people just have found their communities completely unlivable, and they have no other choice. That's why you see so many young kids and teenagers. Those aren't the gang members. To the contrary, those are the guys who are running away from the gangs, right. And so they deserve a second shot.
But how do you do that though, if you don't deal with the terrible governance? You've got a complete criminal military junta character, Hernandez in Honduras. His brother is a mega criminal. So, and you got a narco democracy in Guatemala, and you got a weak government in El Salvador that has, you know, a massive problem with the MS-13 and the other gangs. They seem to rule half of the damn country. So, I mean, we have to look at governance, don't we, and the kind of people we put in power down in these countries.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you've really, you know, gotten the point right. Those Central American countries have been very much destroyed economically, but particularly politically, and the United States has played a very important role, you know, with the Honduran coup, Guatemala, El Salvador, since the 70s. The United States has played a quite negative anti-democratic role, as they had in the United States and in Mexico for the last few decades. Fortunately, in Mexico, we broke through that. You know, this last July 1st, we had finally democratic elections with a progressive president concerned about his people. You know, a similar kind of process would have to happen in Central America. And, you know, the United States should, you know, really promote, you know, authentic democracy in Central America, not this kind of formalistic show of elections, while the only people who are actually competing are the powers that be, and the people aren't actually expressing their will and deciding who's going to be the government.
Well, Dr. John Mill-Ackerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
To the contrary, again, it's a real pleasure and an honor as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mill-Ackerman, who's in Mexico City. He's an author as well as a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, UNAM. And he is an editor of the Mexican Law Review. And he's a columnist at La Jornada and at Proceso, the weekly news magazine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Bye.